Welcome back to Tor's Cabinet. It's been just a couple of days, but I have longer hair now. I got a mat on my desk. Jollibee's got a bigger talk bubble. The audio does not sound like turds. And welcome to my first official episode I've recorded after starting this channel. Everything I've released so far, except the update episode last week. You all right, Jollibee? All right. Which didn't have a script. Everything before that was recorded way back in August, before I knew a damn thing about making videos. Now I'm making videos as they come out. Let's go to Curiosity and Beyond! So, I love bad movies. I don't think that's a surprise. It's not an unusual thing to love. Everyone born since 1980 has seen The Room. The cult following for the Rocky Horror Picture Show dates back even further, passed down through generations. Plenty of one-screen hipster movie halls do weekly showings of both The Room and Rocky Horror to a full house. Mystery Science Theater 3000, which digs up far more obscure bad movies, is on its 13th season and 218th episode. Posters for cheesy 50s B-movies are a popular choice of decoration almost everywhere, and lots of top YouTubers have made a name for themselves riffing on bad movies. Where did this start? Mystery Science Theater and the 70s midnight movie trend went a long way towards popularizing the idea of movies that are so bad they're good, but bad movies really hit the mainstream with the 1980 book The Golden Turkey Awards by the brothers Harry and Michael Medved. Michael Medved was one of America's top film critics for a while, but in the twilight years of his career, he began sinking further and further into the world of conservative commentary, starting with a 1992 book called Hollywood vs. America, in which he argued that mainstream movies were undermining traditional American values. He ended up leaving the world of cinema entirely and writing more conservative choir-preaching books about the free market and, quote, divine providence in the modern era. But in 1980, all of that was a long way off, and Michael Medved was simply a fun, if a bit condescending, movie critic who dredged up a massive haul of awful movies out of obscurity to mock in the Golden Turkey Awards. The book The Golden Turkey Awards was set up like an awards ceremony, with categories including Worst Two-Headed Transplant Movie, Most Brainless Brain Movie, Worst Rodent Movie, which featured a nominee called The Mole People, no relation to my previous episode, Worst Title, which went to Rat Pink Abubu, and Most Badly Bumbled Bee Movie, for which the nominees were The Bees, 1978, The Deadly Bees, 1966, Invasion of the Bee Girls, 1973, and The Swarm, 1978. Then there was the category Most Unerotic Concept in Corn. You know what I'm trying to say, instead of corn. I want to monetize this episode, but probably won't. At least, I'm trying not to get this episode age-restricted. But corn sounds stupid, so you know what I'm gonna say instead? Stag film. That's an old word for corn movies from, like, way back in the silent era. Anyway, in the book, The Golden Turkey Awards, the category Most Unerotic Concept in Stag Films was won by, and I'll just let Medved himself describe this one, "This innovative film, designed exclusively for gay audiences, goes into excruciating detail concerning the erotic career of Jesus Christ. The ads for the film show the face of the Savior with a cross glistening in one eye, while the headline inquires, 'Are you curious about his sexual life?' Filmmaker Ed D. Louie satisfies that curiosity by showing us that the Son of Man was a voracious homosexual. After all, why did he spend all that time hanging around with the apostles? The central character of the film is actually a young gay male in contemporary America whose sexual obsession with Jesus helps him to understand the hidden meaning of the Gospels." This movie was allegedly called Him, and was apparently released in 1974. Medved proceeds to describe a scene from it, in which the aforementioned young gay male in contemporary America visits a priest to talk about his Jesus sex fantasy. The priest, in the confessional box, is extremely turned on and starts to pleasure himself. Most of the films described in the Golden Turkey Awards weren't hard to find. Obscure as they may have been, most turned up at the bottom of video store bargain bins or in the dusty back rooms of one-screen theaters. Many later featured on Mystery Science Theater, the creators of which credited the Golden Turkey Awards with inspiring them to create a show based on roughly the same concept. Once the internet went mainstream in 1995 and IMDb sprung up to diligently archive nearly every film known to humankind, the search for the last few films listed in the Golden Turkey Awards that were still hard to find became a lot easier. But Him was still stubbornly lost. it didn't seem to exist anywhere outside Harry and Michael Medved's book. Around this time, as email also increased in use, chain emails began circulating, spreading rumors among gullible, often elderly people on the internet. The venerable fact-checking site Snopes was started to debunk those rumors, and one of the most popular and long-standing email myths was the claim that some prominent director, who it was varied depending on who the biggest names were in Hollywood at the time, was planning to direct a movie about the life of Jesus that depicted him being gay. In the year 2000, Snopes ran a comprehensive article debunking the gay Jesus movie claims, in which they dug deep into the history of films about Jesus and found that, despite being one of the most portrayed characters in film history, there were no known films, either in existence or in pre-production, about a gay Jesus. They did find Medved's review of the movie Him, but dismissed it as a hoax that never existed, and they had decent evidence to back this up. At the beginning of the Golden Turkey Awards, Harry and Michael Medved included a note. Over 425 actual films are described in this book, but one is a complete hoax. Can you find it? Snopes declared that Him had to be the hoax. It wasn't on IMDb, nor was its supposed director, Ed D. Louie. There was no indication of its existence outside the Medved's book. And even though Michael Medved wasn't well known as a right-wing firebrand yet when the Golden Turkey Awards got published, it seemed a little too perfect that the person who later argued that Hollywood was encouraging the moral and cultural decay of America also seemed to be the only person on Earth who remembered seeing this cartoonishly transgressive movie. Sharp-eyed Snopes readers quickly tried to correct this claim. A different movie mentioned in the Golden Turkey Awards, the Worst Performance by an Animal nominee Dog of Norway, was more likely to be the hoax. The smoking gun was that in the back of the book, the picture of Harry and Michael Medved over the About the Author section showed the two brothers holding a dog. The exact same dog was shown in a purported frame from Dog of Norway. This made sense. After all, the note from the Medveds at the start of the book implied that there was some sort of clue in the book that would point the way to the fake movie. The dog was the clue. Case closed. But there still wasn't any evidence that Him had been a real movie, and Snopes still listed its existence as dubious. They suggested that the real hoax was that there were two fake films in the book, Dog of Norway and Him, because Him just felt like the exact movie Michael Medved would invent as a straw man to prove his point about moral degeneracy on film. What was more likely? That there was a lost gay stag film about Jesus? All records of its existence scrubbed off the face of the earth, only viewed by one person who was, of all people, Michael Medved? Or that Michael Medved made up this movie because he thought it smacked of Hollywood's poor taste. That was the state of the search for Him as the new millennium dawned. But before long, it became harder to make the case that the great American gay Jesus movie had been a hoax, as dribs and drabs of new evidence began coming out. I'm your host, Tor Parsons, this is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian, and welcome to the most shocking episode of Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. The first indication that someone other than Harry and/or Michael Medved knew about the existence of Him came in 2003, when Pimpadelic Wonderland, a website devoted to 1970s nostalgia, posted what appeared to be a newspaper ad for the movie, casually tossed off amid a long list of obscure, hard-to-find 70s movies. The ad matched the Medved's description of the ads for him to a T. Sure enough, it showed a hairy, Jesus-like man with a cross glistening in one eye, and the tagline, "Are you curious about his sexual life?" The ad said him would be premiering at the 55th Street Playhouse, which was a real theater in Midtown Manhattan. At the height of its popularity from the 1960s to the 80s, the 55th Street was a center of New York's artsy, sleazy scene. Think The Velvet Underground or Andy Warhol, who premiered many of his experimental movies there. The 55th Street was all about high art that was low art and low art that was high art. If him really did exist against all odds, of course it would have premiered at the 55th Street Playhouse. Now, the ad could have been someone's work of art. It could have just been cribbed from the description in the Medved's book, with the 55th Street Playhouse detail added for the sake of verisimilitude by someone knowledgeable about gay culture and the stag film scene in 70s New York. But it would have been an impressive Photoshop job even today, and it would have to be a godlike Photoshop job for 2003. It looked like, against all odds, him had been a real film. So, if it had been real and played at a relatively well-known venue in New York, where were all the people who had seen it? Where were the reviews? Where were the dusty VHS tapes of it at adult video stores? Well, the latter have yet to show up. Spoiler alert, him remains lost to this day. But we know a lot more about it than we did at the beginning of the millennium. Not long after the him ad was posted to Pimpadelic Wonderland, rapidly moving the needle closer to him not being a hoax, someone who had noticed this added him to a list of movies that had premiered at the 55th Street Playhouse on cinematreasures.com, a database of historic movie theaters. Cinema Treasures users, many of whom were obscure film buffs who had already heard rumors of him but weren't aware of the Pimpadelic Wonderland development, were sent into a tizzy. Wait, him really existed? Among them, one person commented what they claimed was a review of him from April 1974 in none other than Variety, which read, "Pic depicts graphic sex acts involving Jesus Christ and includes a scene in which a priest is seen masturbating while listening to a confession. The gay-oriented film is about a young man with a sexual obsession for Christ." This was met with skepticism. Like hell would Variety, which has been the mainstream trade publication for the movie industry for as long as movies have existed, the Wall Street Journal for Hollywood, like hell would that magazine review a movie as obscure as him, even if it wasn't also so transgressive. Besides, the brief review quoted by the Cinema Treasures user only included knowledge about him that was already out there, describing the scene with the priest, and other users searched Variety's online archives and couldn't find anything about him. But then, in December 2005, a much more credible review surfaced from the long-standing and legendary magazine Screw. One of the first nationally syndicated adult magazines, Screw ran from 1968 to 2003 under the tagline "Jerk-off Entertainment for Men," though it included much more than that, with graphic advice on how to do better in bed. George Wallace, the infamous white supremacist governor of Alabama, claimed in private in 1977 that reading Screw taught him how to regain his sexual function after he was paralyzed by an assassination attempt. When Screw duly published this claim as a tongue-in-cheek endorsement, Wallace sued Screw. And Screw also included movie reviews. Clearly, him couldn't have been reviewed in Variety, but it couldn't not have been reviewed in Screw. Sure enough, in the April 29th, 1974 issue of Screw, the following article surfaced, incorporating a slur that I will censor, written by none other than Screw's head editor, Al Goldstein. "A bizarrely engrossing new film called Him, playing at the 55th Street Playhouse between 6th and 7th Avenues, has more to recommend it than some of the mismatched shots, mishmash editing, and cheap budget would have allowed. I sat in the theater next to the delicious Marsha Bronstein, editor of Bitch, so much of my enthusiasm for this film may simply have been the proximity of my thighs to hers. Then again, it may have been the vividly poetic photography that loudly proclaimed in favor of cocksucking, ass-fucking, and other lofty pursuits of this downtrodden group of perverts. The plot of Him is theoretically about a gay person who is preoccupied with Christ and constantly has sexual reveries about bawling that great Son of God. The plot might have worked had it been explained to the viewer, but the movie begins inexorably slowly, and for its first 40 minutes it consists of some solid hardcore in the gay vein, and the meaning of the title Him eludes the spectator. Only deeply into the film does one get the necessary material to permit the audience to comprehend the meaning of the plot. By then it's too late, and you don't really give a shit, which is a shame, since so much of this film transcends most of the pap that permeates our perimeters. I thought I had seen everything, but this movie brings in a whole new battery of barnyard banterings from the opening credits, which are played against a stiff cock being licked by a very pretty white pussycat, to a delicious decadent sequel in which a guy fucks a vacuum cleaner with such love that I started to hum, "I want a vacuum cleaner just like the vacuum cleaner that married dear old dad." As they say on Fire Island, it was one of the more legendarily meaningful relationships of last summer, and a blowjob par excellence. Another torrid little scene had a priest jerking off in his confession box as he listened to the tawdry and tear-stained confession of the wandering gay person. The sex on the cross, in particular the graphic anal probings, which is not unlike a World War II boat launching depth charges, was exciting. And of course, the hot, searching lips of Marcia, waxing poetic over my body, kept me truly excited. At least I thought it was Marcia, then when I looked down I saw it was the manager of the theater. Him is a hymn to sodomy and the other brazen activities that mark the twilight world of perversity with so much pain and prurience. Yet to those who are not so frightened by any blemish on their masculinity and can respond to the heated sensuality of another human being, it's a film that will be innervating and titillating. And I thought I was verbose. For the first and only time in my life, I will say this not simply as an expletive, but as a grammatically correct statement, Jesus fucking Christ. Some people still held on to the belief that Him had been a fake, though this time on Al Goldstein's part rather than Michael Medved's. Goldstein was apparently known for making up things like this, and some suggested that Medved had taken Goldstein's joke article literally and believed it to be a serious film. But by this point, the search for Him had become a phenomenon spanning the early internet. It's unfair to say that everyone interested in finding Him wanted to watch the apostles slickle the Son of God's pickle. They wanted to find it because it was so weird, so unique, that it just deserved to be seen, even if nobody wanted to see it. The Goldstein hoax theory was disproved when the Google News Archive went live, and more reviews of Him from spring 1974 were discovered. The Village Voice had apparently not just reviewed it, but carried many ads for it from March to May 1974, and amazingly, the Village Voice review quoted the very same Variety review that had popped up on Cinema Treasures, implying that yes, Variety, the most mainstream movie magazine there is, really had reviewed a gay stag film in 1974. Unfortunately, chances of finding a copy seemed low. Not a lot of gay content from that era survives. People were afraid of being outed as gay simply by being seen coming out of particular theaters. People making gay films rarely, if ever, gave a thought to posterity. Joe Rubin, a collector of, quote, all-male cast films, says that 20% or more are likely lost forever. These movies rarely had more than one film print made. High-quality film reels were super expensive in those days, and having one made was the only way to get your film shown in theaters. Lost film hunters have said that even if just one film print was ever made for Him, that print likely would have cost thousands of dollars, and that could have been more than the filming and marketing budget combined. Hence, the sole release print for Him may have toured the country from underground theater to underground theater until it made a profit, eventually ending up collecting dust in some back room somewhere and being thrown away when the place closed down. The elephant in the room is the AIDS epidemic. So many people involved in the gay community in the 70s, especially in New York, died of AIDS in the 80s and 90s that it's conceivable everyone involved in the production of Him, and nearly everyone who knew them, could be dead now. But new things kept getting revealed. Now that a clear period for when HIM opened in New York had been established, HIM hunters scanned archives of alternative newspapers across the US from 1974 and 75 and found more ads for HIM, showing in more cities. It played in Chicago from January 29th to February 11th, then later in February 1975 at Nob Hill Theater in San Francisco. Remember the name of that place. It surfaced playing at Atlanta's Gay Paris Theater in March, in the Detroit suburb of Highland Park, Michigan in April, in Pittsburgh in May, Houston's French Quarter All-Male Cinema in August, and finally back at the 55th Street Playhouse in January 1976. Other people claimed, unconfirmed by newspaper listings but considered plausible by lost media buffs, that they had seen it playing at some point in Boston, Ottawa, and a different theater in New York. Two tantalizing but totally unconfirmed online claims suggest that HIM's final resting place could have been Europe. One person says that while serving in the military in 1978, they heard rumors that HIM was showing in Scandinavia, though someone who really knows their weird Jesus movies commented that that could be a misidentification of Jeg sa Jesus dø, or I saw Jesus die, a bizarre Danish experimental film that includes Jesus and lots of people fucking, and apparently is not lost, but just not worth watching. Someone else, meanwhile, says they clearly remember seeing HIM at a gay theater in Amsterdam at some point probably in the early 80s, which is the most recent reported screening of HIM. But another screening popped up in old newspapers. In Philadelphia, in February 1975, for almost the same exact dates that HIM played in San Francisco. This was big news on a number of levels. It meant that at least two film prints of HIM must have circulated, basically doubling the chances of finding surviving footage. It meant that HIM must have had a higher budget than most people expected, since for a movie this obscure in 1974, making two film prints must have been a substantial undertaking. Around then, a fascinating theory began to take hold.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future.
Before there was Tommy Wiseau, there was Ed Wood, the original weird creator of weird movies. Remember how I mentioned Plan 9 from Outer Space in my update video because someone thought this channel was named after Tor Johnson, the other famous Tor? Ed Wood directed Plan 9 from Outer Space. People searching for HIM noticed some striking parallels between what we knew about the movie and details of Ed Wood's career. Ed Wood's movies were known for having bizarre scenes unrelated to the main plot that just came barreling out of nowhere, and so did HIM, if Al Goldstein's descriptions of seeing a cat licking a dick and a dude fucking a vacuum cleaner are any indication. What does vacuum cleaner sex have to do with queering the New Testament? Also, Ed Wood got into the adult world in the later years of his career, directing similarly high-concept stag films like 1971's Necromania, A Tale of Weird Love. Many films he's known to have directed around this time are also lost, and the HIM hunters weren't the first people to suggest that there are probably several Ed Wood adult flicks that simply aren't in the public record. And he directed a lot of these films under pseudonyms, some of which incorporated elements of his full name, Edward Davis Wood. Remember what the purported director of HIM was named? Ed D. Louie. What's more, Ed Wood was interested in depicting queer issues on screen. Give this a listen.
Then comes the major surgery, the removal of the man and the formation of the woman. A woman born at the age of 24.
A new life is begun.
The body of the woman within begins to appear now. The world is shocked by a person who changed his sex.
This is the trailer for 1953's Glenn or Glenda, another Ed Wood joint and possibly the first feature film to ever depict a trans main character, let alone in a sympathetic light. Sure, it's presented in an exploitation-y way, and in true Wood fashion, it has many, many incongruous scenes that hit the viewer like a ton of dicks, but Wood really did want to raise the profile of trans people in America with this movie. While Wood was unambiguously attracted to women himself, he also cross-dressed frequently, even in public, and said he dreamt of being reincarnated as a blonde bombshell named Shirley. He maintained that he himself wasn't trans, and honestly, despite all that, I think I agree with him. Sounds like it was more of a fetish for him, like a bimbofication thing, but it did make him sympathetic to trans people. But the bottom line is this: knowing what we know about Ed Wood, it wouldn't be a surprise at all to learn that he directed a gay stag film about Jesus in 1974, featuring unexplained plot cul-de-sacs and herky-jerky editing under a pseudonym, and that film is now lost today. This really brought attention to the search for him. It was interesting enough when it was just the world's most blasphemous lost movie. Now, though, it turned out that it may have been a lost movie by one of the most iconic so-bad-it's-good directors of all time. But, like the four nations living together in harmony, that all changed when the real Ed D. Louie was discovered. The film historian Phil Hall had the bright idea to contact Wakefield Poole, who had been a director of stag films both gay and straight alike in the 1970s, and lived through the AIDS crisis, even as it took most of the other people who were involved in the 70s New York gay scene. He had directed Boys in the Sand in 1971, a movie sometimes seen as legitimizing gay erotica on screen. Fans of Boys in the Sand included gay celebrities like the ballet star Rudolf Nureyev, and straight ones, like singer Liza Minnelli. And Boys in the Sand had premiered at the 55th Street Playhouse. If anyone alive today would be familiar with him, it would be Wakefield Poole, and he was. In fact, he claimed that Ed D. Louie, the director of him, had also been the manager of the 55th Street at the time, which Poole speculates may actually have been what led him to make him, in hoping it would bring more people to the struggling theater. From interviews with Poole and a handful of others, this much was pieced together. Louie was of Chinese descent and spoke with an accent. In fact, his last name was actually spelled L-U-I, though he spelled it like Louie Louie in America, because everyone tended to misspell it that way. While he was the manager of the 55th Street Playhouse, he was not the owner of the property. That was his, quote, relative, Frank Lee, who owned several cruddy little theaters around the country, including the Nob Hill Theater in Lee's hometown of San Francisco, another venue where him was shown. In fact, it's possible more places where him was shown belonged to Frank Lee's portfolio, or even all of them, though we can't be sure because almost all of them are defunct. Frank Lee has been described in one source as Ed Louie's uncle, and in another as Ed Louie's nephew, so there's really no way to say exactly what his relation to Louie was. Louie, or possibly another person named Ed D. Louie, though the circumstantial evidence is strong, had moved to Hawaii by 1976, where he was featured by a local newspaper that reviewed some of his experimental films. Him, or anything that could be him, isn't there, but several other short art films with vaguely shocking and/or sexual themes are, one of which involves him tossing a live carp onto a pile of sand to die, while another features, quote, a dark room, a nude woman, and a room full of exploding firecrackers. The article also said he studied at the New York School of Visual Arts for a while, which is interesting because it seems to validate a comment made under a blog post about him in 2012. Quote, around 1980, a teacher of mine at School of Visual Arts told me one of his students made this film as a school project and showed it at one of the quarterly review committees. So this otherwise unverifiable anonymous claim seems to have some backing in a roundabout way. The fact that comments like these are used as sources and leads in this search, though, just shows just how little we still know about him. So now it was a school project? And must we cobble everything together out of rumors? Is there a critical mass for rumors? Do we ever reach a point where you have enough interlacing rumors that they become facts? Either way, a paper trail suggests that Ed D. Louie was still alive, living in Hawaii until the 2000s. Whether he's still alive today is unknown. Another person connected with him who has definitely surfaced is Vinnie Perillo, whose late boyfriend, Gustav von Will, was the actor who played Jesus in him. Gustav von Will was a muralist who used the moniker Tava, but none of his artworks, which were apparently graphically homoerotic, survive today. He appeared in a handful of other gay movies through the 80s, but unfortunately died of AIDS, a story all too common for people in this episode, in 1991. Perillo did provide the hungry internet with the closest thing we've ever gotten to footage from him, a single still photo of Tava, buck naked, carrying an actual size cross down a New York street. While some of the unearthed reviews of him mentioned that this was a scene in the movie, nobody, not even Perillo himself, was quite sure whether the photo was a still from the movie itself or a candid photo from the production of it. Perillo said he and Tava didn't think much of him when it was made, never thought it would still be remembered all these years later, and certainly has no idea where one would find a copy today. While Tava played Jesus, and this has been confirmed with other people aware of the production like Wakefield Poole, he was not, apparently, the man in the ads. The ones that surfaced long before anything else was known about the rest of the movie, the man who gives a new definition to cross-eyed. That person was one Mike Folds, who had lived with Ed Louie in Columbus, Ohio, before he, Ed, and another friend moved to New York. Folds' identity has been confirmed by a few other people who were part of these social circles, as well as by Jack Holman, whose essay on him may be the most detailed work of journalism anyone's done on the film. But Folds' memory of his involvement in him is weirdly sparse. While he knows the ad that said, "Are you curious about his sexual life?" had a picture of him on it, he couldn't remember if he'd actually been in him. He could confirm that the scene of Jesus carrying the cross through Manhattan naked really happened in the movie, but couldn't remember if any of the other scenes attributed to the movie were real, and said that him wasn't really a stag film. Quote, "It was philosophically and theologically bigger than that." He attributes the haziness of his memories to having taken a lot of drugs around then, which, given that it was the 70s in New York and he looked like Jesus, checks out. Still, Holman notes that Folds seemed to act like he was hiding something. What that could be is unknown. In 2018, a huge development showed up. A tape that could well have been him surfaced. The Kinsey Institute for Research in Sex, Gender, and Reproduction at Indiana University had long been suggested as a potential location him ended up, as they have one of the world's most complete archives of LGBT history, including thousands of items of rare erotica. And sure enough, searching the Kinsey Institute archives, Jack Holman found an untitled reel of 16mm film, the format used by the 55th Street Playhouse, listed in the page notes as a Hand in Hand Films release. Hand in Hand Films was a tiny film distributor, so tiny that when I Google it today, the first two pages return me to an unrelated wedding photo agency of the same name in India. The original Hand in Hand Films was a distributor for a bunch of movies that premiered at the 55th Street Playhouse, including him, according to copyright info. What's more, the reel that Holman found from Hand in Hand Films was marked, "Why is everyone talking about him?" with a single quotation mark at the end, possibly intended to put him in quotes. This is pretty similar to some of the taglines him was marketed with, and it comes from the same obscure distributor. Holman was convinced this had to be him. At the time, the Kinsey Institute said that it would take 6 to 9 months to digitize the film. It's now been 6 years, and one person claims that they got correspondence from the Kinsey Institute confirming that they did not have him in their archives. So, I'm not sure what the deal is with the Kinsey Institute tape, but given that it's been a while, our prince is probably in another castle. And from there, we run out of road. Everything before this has been rumors and hearsay, but corroborated with enough other rumors and hearsay that we have a reasonably accurate picture of what's going on. Now we're in the weeds. An obituary for the stag film actor and director Christopher Rage lists him as one of the movies he starred in, which it was interesting because he was apparently a legend in the gay world, and if he'd been in him, people who saw the movie would probably have remarked on that. Vince Perillo says that the other lead actor in him, who plays the young man obsessed with Jesus, was a guy named Ron. Holman even suggests that him could actually have been two films all along, since he notices a clear difference between the ads that say Ed D. Louie's him and the ones that simply say him. Maybe one was Ed D. Louie's gay Jesus movie and the other one was an even more unknown Christopher Rage movie. Or maybe they were both gay Jesus movies, one a copycat of the other, perhaps one of which was erratically edited and included scenes of guys fucking vacuum cleaners and other extraneous stuff, while the other was philosophically and theologically bigger than that. That would be an M. Night Shyamalan-style ending to the search, and I can't overstate how much I want there to be a totally unexpected revelation like that. But it doesn't meet Occam's razor. There isn't a shred of evidence anywhere else that there were two hymns. It's more plausible that Ed D. Louie made one set of ads, and then Hand in Hand Films made another once they took over distribution. a fun theory about where him might be found, and this isn't a joke, is in a collection at a church or a Catholic university. There's no more diligent archivist than someone trying to ban something. Plenty of churches, televangelists, denominations, and religious schools keep detailed lists of popular culture that they consider blasphemous or satanic, and a gay Jesus movie would definitely fit the bill. And for reference, institutions that have these lists sometimes really do keep all of these blasphemous works on file so they can identify how each blasphemous thing is blasphemous. For a long time, the French National Library had a section called L'Enfer, or Hell, for books considered explicit, and while it was kept under lock and key, today it serves as one of the largest reference sources in the world for Renaissance-era erotica. It's not a stretch to suggest that him could be in some similar collection, at a Catholic diocese headquarters or a Texas megachurch, maybe. Do I believe him will be found someday? Yes. Yes, I do. I know the hunt seems to have lost steam in the last few years, but I think it's plausible, given what we know, that not just two, but several prints were made of the film. There are people who collect these things. It's just a matter of someone having a lightbulb moment at some point along the lines of, hey, what if this person or this collection archived him? They might not be aware that they have him among their collection of obscure films, or they might be aware of him but not aware it's a lost film. An intriguing comment on the Lost Media Wiki from a couple years ago reads, quote, I've been informed in collector's circles of 13 minutes of footage dubbed the Camaria Strip after a prominent insignia in one of the scenes. A Norwegian collector is supposedly in possession of said footage. I'm trying to reach out to them but have had no luck so far. Can this be corroborated by someone? Thanks. In my research, I haven't seen anything else suggesting anything close to that. As far as I can tell, nobody can corroborate this. Googling the phrase Camaria Strip leads back only to that comment, and also a bunch of incredibly sketchy, give-your-laptop-AIDS kind of sites decorated with cartoon girls in bikinis and innumerable pop-up ads, like the sort of thing you might expect to be led to if you clicked one of those hot singles in your area ads. Every single one of them had a long list of search tabs, like boobs, ass, blowjob, and then, among things that gooners might search, the phrase Camaria Strip. From what I can tell, that's not a reference to something you can goon to. It isn't Googled enough for Google Trends to have data on it. The word Camaria, which is apparently a given name, has been Googled a grand total of 62 times since September. That's less than two a day, somewhere in the world, among billions of Google users. What connection, if any, do these sites have to him? What does the phrase Camaria Strip really mean? I don't know, and I don't know if I want to know. This is some Candle Cove shit. There's a quote from The Two Towers in which Gandalf describes his epic battle with the Balrog to Merry and Pippin that, far, far below the deepest delving of the dwarves, the world is gnawed by nameless things. Even Sauron knows them not. They are older than he. Now I have walked there, but I will bring no report to darken the light of day. That's true of the internet, too. Everyone knows about the deep web, which is where everything you can't directly search Google for is, and the dark web, where hitmen and drug dealers peddle their wares. In this analogy, you could say that someplace like Silk Road is the Balrog. Malware and hot singles in your area ads are common or garden orcs. But every now and then, you run into things like the Camaria Strip. The nameless things. They're unknowable. They're always around you, below your feet, or in this case, below your first few pages of search results. They're the internet's stares in the woods. We'll never really be threatened by them, but they're there, and nobody knows where they come from. Him is not there. Him is not buried that deep. It's probably just not on the internet, unlike almost all other movies. It's sometimes said that we are the first generation in humanity's permanent record, because digital files, the way all our data is saved that future historians will learn about us through, don't degrade over time. That isn't quite true, but it is true that the internet has been a boon to those who search for lost media. Once something is online, it isn't lost. And people who remember seeing particular lost movies or shows or listening to lost music can now coordinate their searches much better. With enough Adderall, the internet could recreate the contents of the Library of Alexandria. It's no wonder lost media, long thought to be unfindable, pops up online these days with astonishing regularity. 2024 has been the most amazing year for lost media in anyone's memory. Hell, when I started this channel, I used the most mysterious song on the internet as my intro because I knew nobody could serve me a copyright strike for it. Just 2 weeks after I posted my first video, it was identified as Subways of Your Mind by Fex, one of the internet's greatest mysteries, solved. One of these days, him is going to be right alongside it. The lost gay Jesus movie will become the found gay Jesus movie. An honest-to-God resurrection. You might call it the Second Coming.
Love.